Strengthen your immune system with Goldman Laboratories liposomal vitamin C and get 10% off. Quote 10 off at goldmanlaboratories.com.
Hello and welcome to the Brain Health and Beyond show on the UK Health Radio with your hosts, Dean and Aisha Sherzai.
We're so excited to be here. This is the beginning of hopefully a long relationship with our UK partners and friends and families. And we are hoping to bring light to one of the most important concepts, the brain.
So a little bit about ourselves. This is our first show, and I'm so excited that we're here. Dean and I are a husband and wife neurologist team, and we are professors of neurology at Loma Linda University Health in Southern California, United States.
And we also do research. We do quite a bit of research both at the clinical trial level as well as population level, and looking at the different aspects of lifestyle and epigenetics on health and brain health in particular.
I think one of the unique things about us, Dean, I think you'd agree with me, is that we have the advantage of being with patients and dealing with the sickness part of this whole health spectrum, and also seeing how it affects families and individuals in numerous ways. But at the same time, having the privilege of looking at the different factors that bring upon those diseases in a community setting or in a population setting.
Absolutely. I think it speaks to the why. We always say the most important thing in your life is to know your why. Really the core why. What's the driving factor in your life? What's the purpose? Starts with why. And you can't know the why of brain health unless you're doing, you know, work at all these levels. So I think we're one of the unique researchers as individuals, but then as partners to work at the clinic level, at the lab level, and at the population level. I don't know anybody who does population level work, and we'll speak about that further later on, which is one of the most unique studies and programs we are actually in charge of. Is the Beach Cities Health District, where an entire district is being studied as far as effect of lifestyle on their brain health. So we're involved at every phase. And speaking of the why, I think it's good to start with our own why, both as far as the science of why we went into the science and also as far as the personal whys.
I think our first conversation was around that why when we first met. We both had experienced firsthand what dementia was. We had two grandparents each that were diagnosed with Alzheimer's disease and a form of dementia. And we saw the pain that they went through. We saw the pain and the difficulties that our parents experienced seeing their parents go through this. And I believe it stayed with us. I remember when my grandfather was diagnosed with dementia, and my mother took care of him for many years, and I saw this incredibly strong man who was the leader of the family, and he was an inspiration to all of us, slowly and gradually start losing parts of himself. His personality completely changed. He wasn't able to do things for himself. Things as simple as buttoning down his shirt. And it came to a point where he relied on everything, on my mom for everything. And it was just painful to see that. And you experienced something like that too.
Exactly. Same thing. A grandfather and a grandmother, both of them incredibly powerful. Matriarch and patriarch of the family. And these powerful people, watching them, lose parts of themselves in small bits. In fact, for those who have read our book, or speaking of the book, that's another thing that we'll talk about, is the book that we've written and the book that we are about to write, The Alzheimer's Solution. You will have read a part about where we are all sitting around in our hunting lodge. At the time, I was a hunter, not anymore. But we're sitting down and we're playing chess with this super brain, all the cousins, all the young cousins, and all of a sudden this man who was a master at chess forgot how to move the knight. For those of you who are familiar with chess, it's a little bit of an unusual move. And that threw us all. And then from there, over the next few years, we saw him suffer in small increments. So that was probably, especially now looking in retrospect, that was the driver of what pushed me towards this. The other driver was that every conversation, and you are the same, from a very health-oriented family, doctors, physicians, and no matter what their specialty, whatever we sat around dinner table, the talk was about the brain.
We're all very fascinated about the brain, about how it works, about not necessarily just the disease, but this incredible capacity that we all have and the things that we can do when we put our minds into it.
So literally and fairly. Yeah, absolutely. Up to recently, I mean, we're talking, I mean, even we still have the language, don't we? You know, you'll find it in your heart. No, you're not going to find it in your heart. That thing that you're talking about, it's actually in the limbic system of the brain. We're beginning to learn about this amazing brain.
So in a way, this is the center of the brain, isn't it?
It is the center of the brain. And we're learning about it. We're learning not just how to avoid diseases, but to expand cognitive capacity. That's what's exciting. We are expanding cognitive capacity and we're changing. We're going to see changes in our world, in our conscious world in the next decade with all this augmented reality and augmented biology. We will have some shows about those topics as well. And you will be absolutely floored when you hear the concepts that are right there in the near horizon.
It's fascinating where we have come since, you know, the early ages where people relied on phrenology or just, you know, diagrams of what the brain could be, you know, the initial autopsy drawings of the brain. And now we have tools like the functional MRI where you can put somebody inside an MRI machine and have them memorize certain things or do some mental tasks, and you can see live how their brain is functioning, how the different parts of the brain get oxygenated. And, you know, you were showing me an article just a couple of days ago where they were able to look at the blood vessels and, you know, almost cellular level of the brain with an MRI.
Exactly.
That was incredible.
Well, let's some background as far as our training. So my training, speaking of that, Aisha talked about the fMRI. Well, she was a researcher in UCSD, which is one of the top neuroscience programs in the country. But at the time, 10 years ago, it was the number one neuroscience program. And Aisha was doing fMRI work, looking at brain functional representation as the person is thinking or doing activities and relating that to disease and capacity. So she's done some amazing work, and you'll see about some of the other work that she's done in lifestyle and nutrition, which is her strength.
And you were in the National Institutes of Health in the Experimental Therapeutics Department of National Institutes of Health, or NIH, in Bethesda, Maryland. And you were involved in some of the groundbreaking research of stem cell therapy, right?
You know, I promise you, this was not set up where she talks about me and I talk, but it came out pretty good. We are both trained in these classic and important ways of basic science and imaging, and we'll bring some of that into where we are now, including where we are now is absolutely remarkable. Reading people's thoughts through EEGs, that's where we are. That's exciting. So with that said, going back to the why is the science. The why is the brain, not just avoiding disease, but creating capacity. Now, let's talk about this little brain, this little 3-pound organ, this organ that's 2% of our body's weight, but consumes 25% of body's energy and up to 50% of its oxygen at times. This brain that demanded so much energy that evolution actually created some time for it to relax. We call that sleep. Mm-hmm. Sleep is literally there for brain to have access to files, folders, to organize and to cleanse. Despite the dangers that the body will experience, that's how much demand was there. And this brain is remarkable because it has 87 billion neurons, but it can have as many as a quadrillion connections.
Wow.
And that's, somebody has done a mathematical model of 1 × 10^50 processing power, whether that's near or not. That's more than any computer present today. That's what we're talking about. And when people say that we only use 10% of body's brain's capacity, that's not true. We use 100%, but we use it at 1% efficiency. That's another thing we want to talk about, bringing out the full potential of the brain. And to that extent, we are talking not about the end of the age where people are experiencing disease, where we think you can actually avoid disease and cognitive diseases and expand capacity, but even early life. And we have two kids, and you'll get to know them. They will be part of this. They've written a book, actually two books. We're talking about expanding kids' brain capacity beyond anything anybody could imagine. We're talking about redefining concepts like ADD. We're talking about looking at creativity that's subdued as we get older and then manifests when a pathology arises, a disease arises. And why would that be the case? Because naturally, as a society, we subdue and diminish creative capacities of the brain so we can do, you know, simple everyday tasks. So that's what this show will be about. We'll talk about disease and how to avoid it, but some beautiful other concepts as well.
Before we expand a little bit about brain capacity and how one can expand it, let's touch on the tsunami that we're all facing, the disease. You know, you and I are both neurologists in the clinic, and you know, I'm actually a stroke specialist. I trained at Columbia University in stroke prevention and epidemiology of stroke. And you, Dean, you focused on geriatrics and dementia. So cognitive aging is your specialty. So we both see a spectrum of patients, and the disease that is not really under control is dementia. And can you explain what dementia is?
Yeah, so dementia in general is the umbrella category, and then under dementia there are multiple other types of dementia, such as Alzheimer's and Lewy body disease and Parkinson's dementia and frontotemporal lobe dementia and others.
But vascular dementia.
And vascular,
the
big one,
yes. When
somebody
has a stroke and there's damage to the blood vessels.
Correct, correct. And dementia by definition is when somebody's having difficulty with cognitive capacity, be it memory or executive function, and we'll explain all those terms in more detail. To the extent that they can't do some of the daily activities that they could do before.
So it's not like when somebody starts losing their keys or they don't know where they place things around the house. That's not necessarily dementia.
I hope not. Otherwise, I would be in trouble.
We both would be in that category.
A lot of people would be, yes. And whenever we give talks and we start defining some of the aspects, you see the worry in populations in the audience's eyes.
But when it expands to the point where it's stopping you from doing your regular activities of daily living, and it's a huge impediment in you moving forward, that's when it becomes a problem.
Correct. If you can't drive anymore or having significant difficulty with driving, if you can't do your finances where you could do before, and now you're having difficulty, that's significant. Where you can't take care of your medications and are having difficulty under, not just forgetting it once in a while here and there, but that's dementia.
The now, numbers are very scary.
It is. And I'll give you numbers in UK, US, and other places. In US, the numbers are really scary. I mean, we're talking about the fastest growing epidemic. You've heard terms such as tsunami and avalanche. Well, they're not far from the truth. We're talking and in a population that's aging fast, and that's most countries such as UK and Japan and United States, there's a correlation with aging, mm-hmm. but we think that, and many others think that, it's not a direct correlation. It's something that can be, for a great majority, avoided. Now, let's talk about that. We are an aging society. The fastest growing population in most Western countries are those 50 and above. In those 65 and above, the prevalence of dementia is 10%, and it doubles every 10 years thereafter. Where in when you're at 85, nearly 50% of the population, those 85 and above, have dementia. In UK, we have 850,000 people with dementia, and the numbers will rise to up to 1 million by 2025.
Wow.
And to 2 million by 2051. I mean, this should scare everybody.
Right.
The costs are even worse. The second costliest disease in US is $120 billion. The third costliest is all cancers combined at $60 billion. The cost of the Alzheimer's alone, direct cost, is $290 billion plus. And that doesn't even take into consideration the indirect cost to the families, jobs lost, time lost. And that number is expected to go to above 1.1 billion by 2040, 2050. Mm-hmm. That should scare us all.
Right, right. And worst thing is there's no treatment for it.
There isn't.
Years and years of spending money on clinical trials and looking at different medication and attacking different types of proteins that are supposedly responsible for cognitive impairment have been a failure. We have had 0% success rate when it comes to treatment of dementia.
We have. I mean, and there's a reason for that. I think we could have had much greater success if we weren't so myopic and linear and very focused on one thing and had a broader perspective. And we've shown that in our book and in our science. But billions and billions of dollars spent, and we still have zero medication for, you know, altering the disease course. Whatever medicines we have are there just to, you know, treat the symptoms for a few years, but the disease continues at the same rate.
And I think it's because of that myth that was created decades ago in the scientific world, where they incriminated one or two proteins, namely amyloid protein, which is, you know, a downstream process. You know, so there's a lot of things going on in the body and in the brain that causes the damage, but everybody focuses on the end product. And all of the medication have been focused on either getting rid of amyloid or cleaving it or, you know, affecting it in some way.
Blocking it, slapping it, whatever they needed to do.
But nobody, or let's say very few people, are actually aware of the bigger process, of the bigger picture, of what actually happens upstream in the disease process.
Correct. And we were in the middle of this battle. We were, you know, I was at Experimental Therapeutics Branch of NIH, National Institutes of Health. I mean, that's the where you do all the molecular research. And Aisha and I were in UCSD, where we looked at all these clinical trials.
UCSD stands for UC San Diego.
San Diego.
University
yeah.
of California, San Diego.
And over and over and over again. And then you did your fellowship at Columbia right. University in New York. And failure after failure. So we decided to take a different course.
I think, you know, as medical students and doctors, you kind of get pigeonholed into a particular way because, you know, you see your mentors going towards a specific directions. You see that there's support for a specific type of research and it's always encouraged. You're always encouraged. You remember when we had conversations with our mentors about going through a different route of looking at prevention or the bigger picture, we were warned. We were told that this may be a career suicide for us.
Yes, I mean, repeatedly. And I think that was the most courageous thing we've ever done.
I agree.
There's nothing scarier than having invested 4 years, 5 years in college, 4 years in medical school, then comes 4 to 5 years of residency, and in your case, you did also a preventive medicine residency, and you're in the fellowship after 12, 13, 14 years, and you're about to take a step, and somebody says, oh, your career is about to end if you go in that direction. Mm-hmm. And not just by one person, but by repeated, you know, mentors. And the reason is, you're right, because they, you know, it's remarkable that we think that intelligent people can see the bigger picture. No, once you get in a rut, you get in a direction, in a column, it's difficult to see outside of that.
Mm-hmm.
And the same thing as, and the other element is where the funding comes from.
Right.
The funding is looking at simple, quick answers in a complex model. you know, the body, for God's sakes. I mean, millions and millions of molecules working together and across time and space and environmental factors, and you want to find the answer to all of that interaction across time and space by manipulating one molecule? Well, that's how funding works, because you know that you can fund that. It's fundable. You know that there's a timeline that you can follow with that one little molecule. So just keep spending money on different molecules. But looking at the more complex picture, it's too daunting and too complex. And human nature, if it's complex, you close your eyes.
And I think it's a reflection of our desire for instant gratification in any process as human beings. We want a quick fix. We want something that can quickly address the problem and get rid of it. And that's why everybody's been looking at a pill, at one medication fixing the whole problem. And that's not how it works in the brain, especially in the brain. It doesn't work like that in the body, but especially in the brain.
Yeah, I mean, this organ that doesn't even sleep, that has billions of neurons, 87 billion neurons, and that's, oh, and then the glia, which are these supporting cells, outnumber the neurons by 10 to 1. And this incredible universe, which starts changing from the, you know, even pre-birth, and evolves continuously, and we want to, without knowing all the mechanisms, we want to just alter the disease process that accumulated over years with one molecule.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, even just saying it sounds absurd.
It really is silly.
It is. So we decided to kind of take a different path, as the poet says, the path less traveled. We said we were going to look at population studies or places where people lived longer and possibly even did better as far as cognition as they lived longer. So we looked at these places called the Blue Zones. And for those of you who don't know it, an incredible gentleman from National Geographic, a friend of ours, Dan Buettner, studied this many years ago and looked at populations where people lived distinctly longer and healthier than other places. And they looked at it with a fine-tooth comb and made sure that this is accurate. And it's not like one of those stories that you hear that in Kazakhstan or in some island off of Pacific, people live to 150 and all they eat is yogurt. Well, those are all fake stories. There's no shortage of false anecdotes, especially now with the internet.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what we have to face every day, you know. But these blue zones were places where people live longer and healthier, which included Okinawa, Japan, and Nicosia, as well as Sardinia.
Yeah.
And as
Sardinia,
well as
Italy.
Italy. And then one of them was Loma Linda, California.
Correct.
And lo and behold, it was the only one in the United States, and it was the only one that had a population that was being studied through a major grant from NIH. And they had shown previously that people who lived in, well, it's not the population. In case of Loma Linda, it's the religion. It's the Seventh-day Adventists that have certain practices that is believed to have led to them living much healthier and longer than everybody else, as much as 10 to 14 years longer and healthier than everybody else. So we said, let's, and this was validated. It wasn't a story. It wasn't even a bunch of case studies. It was 100,000 people being closely studied, and the data was just remarkable. When it came to cancer, much fewer cases, significantly lower. Diabetes, half as many. Heart disease, stroke. So we said we were going to go and study the brain diseases such as stroke and Alzheimer's. And as we came to Loma Linda, and Aisha, you were starting your another residency in both preventive medicine and neurology.
Correct. And I'm just learning about Loma Linda and the excitement of being involved in research to study this incredible population, initiated the desire to do a little bit more than just neurology.
Yeah.
And so, you know, I went into preventive medicine residency and then did a combination of preventive medicine and neurology. And in our clinic, we used to, see all kinds of patients, but we rarely saw people from the local area, from Loma Linda, having dementia and cognitive diseases. And it wasn't because they didn't like us, or it wasn't because there was another hospital around. I think Loma Linda was the hospital, the main hospital, tertiary hospital area in a very large catchment area. It just happened that a lot of them were really healthy. I mean, if you remember, we used to go to the gym early in the morning, and there would be, we would easily see centenarians and, you know, and nonagenarians with their dumbbells in their hand, ready to climb the treadmill and, you know, do a run. Very, very healthy. And it was also interesting that right across the highway, just a few miles away from Loma Linda, when we used to have a community clinic, we still do there, we were faced with one of the unhealthiest people or populations in the country, where you'd see diabetes and high blood pressure and high cholesterol in their 30s and 40s, rampant strokes and brain diseases, mm-hmm. Parkinson's disease and dementia. And so, you know, we didn't just read about it in papers. We saw it on a daily basis, correct. The difference in health status of these two communities that were right next to each other.
In fact, they were contiguous in a way. Many of the populations were Seventh-day Adventists, but the others that weren't across the street, they had much lower mortality, higher mortality from diseases and much more chronic diseases.
Yeah.
And we gave many talks in churches, and we would, Aisha and I are not much fun parties, and when we kind of early on detect when somebody has some what they call bradykinesia and bradykinesia, which is the slow movement and slow speaking, which comes from vascular diseases of the brain, which are usually not diagnosed as anything, but it's the early signs of cognitive decline.
Right.
And we would see this significant difference between the two sides. And it wasn't so much racial as it was socioeconomic and a problem of access, which
correct.
Is usually in public health, it's a problem of access. Access to information, access to resources. So in our clinic, over 5 years, we saw 5,000 people. Over 5 years, we saw 3,000 people with dementia. And in a region where 50% of population, or roughly 50%, are vegetarians, or more importantly, plant-based, and are more active physically and socially. That's another very important point. You would expect 50%, given that the 50% of the population are like that, at least 50% of the 3,000 would be from this population,
mm-hmm.
from the population that's plant-based, also educated. But the numbers were just overwhelmingly
yes.
lower. We're talking about 19 out of 3,000.
So just a handful.
Just a handful. Well,
a handful of people yeah. actually had a healthy life and they developed a disease.
Yeah, and this could not be, in science, you talk about confound. You talk about other variables that might be at play.
Mm-hmm.
So it couldn't be the fact that they were trying to avoid us, because the Seventh-day Adventists, actually, the hospital, they're much more knowledgeable about healthcare. They're much more, the greater access to the clinic and our clinic. And it wasn't about distance, because they're right there. It wasn't about any other factor except disease prevalence, or at least later onset. Now, again, we as scientists, we make sure that we call anecdotal data anecdotal data. And you will hear us be very, very rigid as far as the science is concerned. I mean, when we wrote the book, we could have made a big deal out of this. Remember, the whole coconut oil revolution was based on an anecdote of one doctor who said that they gave medicine to their husband who had Alzheimer's, which
nobody's
coconut oil,
yeah.
and they were cured. Nobody checked it, and then that whole revolution started. We had an anecdote, a cross-sectional anecdote of 3,000, which showed out of that population, which should have had 1,500 that were plant-based and active, and we only saw 19.
Mm-hmm.
And then we did much more research in the studies itself, and in the populations, and in other populations as well.
Right. And that's when we started writing about this, and we described the research, and we started reading more about other populations. You know, Loma Linda had this large database, but, you know, when you look at other populations, whether they're in the United States or in other parts of the world, we saw that there was a consistent effect, positive effect of lifestyle on brain diseases. Whether it was Rush University that came out with their MIND diet, which is, you know, a combination of Mediterranean diet and a diet that is low in sodium, that it, you know, people who adhere to that kind of a diet, they reduce their risk of developing Alzheimer's disease by 53%.
Yes.
That was incredible.
We'll be talking about the science a lot more. So we just wanted to titillate you. There's a mountain of science that speaks to lifestyle and brain health.
Mm-hmm.
And to us, once we got into that realm, it was surprising that when we were in NIH or UCSD or Columbia, we wouldn't hear about it as much.
I was almost angry.
Yes.
Because, you know, all of this population epidemiological data and even clinical trials that studied lifestyle wasn't discussed as much as it should have.
And that was ignorance. Now we have even a bigger problem. There's noise.
Mm.
And now this has become a political issue almost. The politics is creating science, meaning that the opposition to the whole food plant-based diet, which wants to preserve the idea that meats and dairy and sugar is good for you, is creating a whole set of its own science. And now we have the ketos and the paleos and the South Beach and diet du jour. And some of them actually are old diets that are reshaped and they come in different ways. And we'll talk about that, where that comes from. Where is the neuroscience of why we have difficulty evolving ideas? I can give you a clue. It's in the limbic system. We'll talk about that. But now it's not even just ignorance. Now it's active resistance and money being put to alter science.
Mm-hmm.
And it's difficult. I mean, it took 7,000 publications to change our relationship with cigarettes. In fact, in the 50s, we had doctors advertising and on TV that cigarettes are good for you.
Mm-hmm. Yes. And I remember seeing the pictures and the posters of doctors.
Not from the 50s. You're way younger than
Well, obviously. I mean, you know, you can actually see them everywhere nowadays.
Yes.
They sell them just for fun.
We do, yes.
One of our doctor friends actually has that on his wall. There's a doctor, I think he's an ENT specialist with, you know, that little mirror on his
yes.
forehead. And he's smoking a Camel cigarette saying, you know, it can boost your energy when you're feeling down and it can clear your throat.
Yeah.
So we've come a long way.
We have. But that's our relationship with food and some of the other things, such as mental activity, is a lot closer than it was with cigarettes. Cigarettes was an exogenous, outer product that we didn't have as close a relationship, and that took 7,000 papers, and they can, you know, the merchants of doubt, all they had to do was create doubt for people to just throw their arms up and say, oh, we'll just stay to status quo. That's happening now, and for us as public health individuals, it's critical that we speak out for the science. And then a third group that's causing noise is doctors and scientists that come in with science on the surface, but it's a foot in the door thing because the next step is they're selling their vitamins.
Mm. Yes, we see a lot of those, unfortunately.
Yeah, I mean, the number one book is about the fact that plants have this thing called lectins, which is supposed to be bad for you, which actually the science is extremely weak. But what should have given it away was that as the book came out, The gentleman also was selling his lectin-blocking pills.
So he created the disease and he created the treatment?
That's pretty brilliant as far as business model, but not so ethical as far as healthcare is concerned.
Unfortunately,
so we have some challenges. And now when it comes to lifestyle and healthcare, we have three challenges. So we say that, you know, we work on healthcare and what we're facing is a world of sick care.
Right, right. And it's a challenge for doctors who have integrity, who want to do it the right way, because it's unfortunately we're living in an era where, you know, everybody's looking for a magical pill. And we've all been trained in medical school to deal with disease at its end stage, so sick care. And rarely do we talk about prevention and looking at the spectrum of health. I don't even remember talking about prevention and, you know, lifestyle, you know, importance of nutrition and exercise and sleep and things of that nature during medical school, do you?
No.
I remember we had an epidemiology class and it was probably for an hour or two in the entire university course. So sick care is good. We need it. There are fabulous doctors and physicians who are doing great work as far as, you know, surgeries and acute treatment of disease is concerned. We need that. But in a society where we have treatment for a lot of diseases and we're living longer and we're dealing with chronic diseases of aging, we can't apply that model anymore. We have to look at healthcare versus sick care.
There's plenty of data that if you start with healthcare, which means before the person has the disease, and you implement the necessary environmental and educational elements, that you can profoundly reduce the cost of even sick care.
Yeah, absolutely.
People don't end up having strokes. We see this in the clinic we work, in the low-income clinic, where individuals in their 40s are having strokes. And all of that can be avoided with knowledge and access. So sick care is important once a person has disease. But what if we start focusing in the communities? And that's actually one of the major projects that we're leading at the community level and hoping to actually expand it to. Right now it's in several cities in the United States, and we want to expand it throughout the world. And it's funding is through our non-for-profit. In fact, most of what we make goes to our non-profit, which is healthyminds initiative.org. And the purpose of the Healthy Minds Initiative is twofold. One is increase information and knowledge. Sorry, threefold. Two is create the resources in the community so where they can actually start doing healthcare for themselves and for their communities. And thirdly, do the good research that confirms. And confirms not just confirming our own bias, but true science. So those are the three legs upon which the Healthy Minds Initiative stands.
And it's in the communities that healthcare actually starts.
Yes.
We have very limited time in our clinic and in the hospital, and that interaction is very brief. And yes, there may be some transfer of knowledge and some information as far as the disease is concerned. But what you and I are trying to do is to create ambassadors in the community who can continuously spread and disperse information, true, validated, evidence-based information without any noise or clutter.
Correct. I mean, we were kind of reluctant at first to do the social media stuff and the radio and everything else.
Oh, I remember how awkward it was for us to stand in our pantry and talk about nutrition in front of a camera.
it is still a little awkward, but I think it's extremely important. We have to evolve with the time. How else can you spread information, hopefully good information and validated information and personal information in a way where people can inculcate and make it part of their own life? This is the only way we can do it, and we're excited about this. Now, the third element of our approach is, one is, you know, prevention of diseases. Second is knowledge base and research and all of that. But the other element is actually what we spoke about earlier. If you start early enough with proper environment, which will help you have healthcare and avoid disease, guess what else you will have, especially when it comes to the brain? You will have greater cognitive capacity at any age. Right now, the way we approach children is, I mean, arcane. We put 35 young men in a room after you've given them a sugary breakfast, and they're supposed to just sit there quietly doing work that's not aligned to their capacities, to their interests. And when they are not behaving properly, young men or women, we give titles such as ADHD and ADD and start medicating them. There is true ADD and true ADHD, but it's significantly overstated. And we have to start addressing them at the community level in a more complex model, in a more personalized model around each child and each person's capacities, interests, and directions. And by doing that, we will be doing what we talk about, which is expanding cognitive capacity.
Right. Right.
I mean, significantly increasing cognitive capacity. Where we are at Beach Cities, children are taught how to develop better focus. Mm-hmm. I mean, when did you ever talk about that? But focus is the gatekeeper of consciousness, and we are never trained to develop better focus. So another element is capacity, cognitive capacity. And then in between, we'll talk about lots of interesting little stories.
And also, something that you're passionate about, Dean, is human behavior and creation of habits. I think there might be, and there are, a lot of great physicians and scientists who are presenting great information, and they're a great channel between the scientific world and the community. But the approach is erroneous. The way to change habits, the way to implement healthy habits, whether it's in a for an individual or in a family or in a community, is to make it personal, a personalized program. And I know that a lot of people use that word personalized, but essentially what it means is to meet the person with their resources, to find out their strengths and their weaknesses, their capacity, and also their level of awareness of where they are and where they want to be.
Absolutely.
And that's how you create programs where you break everything down into small pieces, make sure they succeed in making small habits, and continue that by changing their environment so they develop great habits later on.
Absolutely. I mean, Aisha wonderfully laid out one of our passions, which is habit. Without that, all we're doing is gathering information and throwing it at people and hoping that it sticks, and it never does. And that's why we go from diet to diet, mm-hmm. from program to program, from New Year resolution to New Year resolution. Unless we create habits, nothing will change. And we'll have an entire show on habits, how to create actually many shows, because it's such an important concept. And other things such as my least favorite word in English language, which is
motivation.
Motivation. And it's such a disempowering, demotivating term, because it's as if you're supposed to know what that is and you're supposed to have it all the time. No, there's a way that you can operationalize and create that in you. And we'll talk about that. And that's at the core of this, not just the science about, you know, food or exercise or meditation or other things. But how do you, once you have the data, how do you make it part of yourself, that it's no longer a chore, that it comes naturally? Because without that, it will go back to the resting state, to the natural state that it's used to.
I think that is key to our work towards a healthier community. I think that is key. That is at the core. This all or none phenomenon, you know, of either following a program or you're completely drop out of it, that has never worked, that will never work. And people should be given choices of how to add healthier habits in their lives.
Absolutely. So we are nearly at the end of our program for today. This is the beginning of a beautiful journey between us and you, and we'd love to hear from you as well as far as what topics you would love to hear. And we have a whole list of topics that we want to talk about and with the people that we need to talk about, that we want to bring into these conversations. But the important thing here is that we understand that brain function is no longer a black box. The brain is no longer a black box. We are beginning to learn about brain and its effect on everything, even why we sing. What is, you know, why do we, what's music to us? How does it, you know, what does it translate to? Why we dance? There is a whole neuroscience behind that. And more importantly, you know, how can we live in a way that can bring out our full potential? We always, when we give talks, we say that, you know, I hope we don't offend the cardiologists and the doctors and other specialties. We say that the rest of the brain is there to carry, the rest of the body is there to carry the brain.
Right. Yeah. And if you address the brain and if you take care of the brain, you've taken care of the rest of the body, because by taking care of your brain, you've taken care of your emotions, your habits, your motivations, your proclivities, and if you have a sound mind, you'll make better decisions.
Absolutely. And the other reason that the brain is so important is because of that hungry little machine is so overwhelmed that if you do the things necessary to maintain its function, forget about the heart and the kidney and the liver and everything else, they will be taken care of, because this hungry 3-pound organ is overwhelmed.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so there is a way to bring its full potential. As much as it is overwhelmed, it also is incredibly resilient. And that's the secret. That's the secret of the 21st century. That resilience is where we will find not just greater cognitive capacity, not just disease avoidance, but a whole new world of understanding of the brain and everything around us.
I know that you and I talk about this all the time, and you know, this is our job, but just describing it again, it gives me so much joy and energy, because we are sharing it with a whole new crowd and a population on the radio, and we're very excited. So we are going to end this show today with the hopes of getting back with you all with a new topic, with a new story, and a new guest to discuss phenomenal concepts about the mind and brain. And you will find us on social media as Team Shares Eye. We are on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter as Team Shares Eye. That would be at Team Shares Eye. Our book's title is The Alzheimer's Solution, and you can find that on Amazon and most other book vendors, whether online or physical. And our website is teamshareseye.com. For those of you who are interested in finding out about our non-for-profit organization, it's called healthymindsinitiative.org. That's the website.
And let's not forget the kids.
Yes, our son and daughter, Alex and Sophia Shareseye, have written two books. Their latest book is called Super Me. It's about brain health for kids, and you can find that on Amazon as well.
It's called Super Me, and it's about from a beautiful perspective from children.
Exactly. And that's basically it. Thank you so much for joining us, and we look forward to speaking with you all again. Have a wonderful day.
Thank you.